today on Against the Grain. Albert Einstein was a brilliant scientist, but he was also a socialist. I'm CS. John Bellamy Foster talks about Einstein's politics and Einstein's essay in the inaugural issue of the Socialist magazine Monthly Review in 1949, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Albert Einstein has been called one of the greatest scientific thinkers of all time. Best known for his theory of relativity, Einstein also had a political side, one that many observers considered too left, too radical, too unseemly for someone of his stature. Monthly Review, an independent socialist magazine that turned 75 this year, featured in its inaugural May 1949 issue an essay by Einstein titled Why Socialism? So what was Einstein's political commitment to socialism? What actions did he take in an effort to realize his political aspirations? And how were those efforts received? And what arguments did he make in that 1949 essay about why socialism was a desirable and urgently needed alternative to capitalism? John Bellamy Foster is the editor of Monthly Review and professor emeritus of sociology at the University of Oregon. In Monthly Review's May 2024 issue, John contributed an essay about Einstein's politics and his association with Monthly Review. John also has a new book out. It's called The Dialectics of Ecology, which you'll hear about later this hour. When John Bellamy Foster and I connected recently, I asked about Einstein's early inclinations toward radical politics.
He was a socialist, a radical as far back as we know, when he was in Switzerland, when he was doing his major studies in physics and spending time in the Odeon Cafe. He was around radicals, around socialists who were there. He was very much part of socialism in his everyday life from the beginning as an adult, as far back as we have records.
Do we have any sense of what drew him to socialism?
No, I don't think he ever explained how he became a socialist. He was a materialist as a scientist. He was a realist. And that, I think, drew him to the socialism of his day. There are also reactionary trends developing in Germany and in Switzerland, and he was repelled by that. But you know, at the time that Einstein was developing his ideas, the German Social Democratic Party, which was a socialist party, was the second biggest political party in Germany. So socialism was not in any way on the margins. It was very much part of the political discussion in the society, and I think he just fit right within that. The amazing thing is just how strong his convictions in that respect were and how much he did in terms of support for socialism all through his life.
What do we know about his affinity toward, if he did have affinities toward, Marx and Lenin?
He, on a number of occasions, he talked about Marx's ideas and Marx with great respect. He saw Marx as one of the two greatest Jewish thinkers in history. He put Marx next to Spinoza in that respect. He used Marx's ideas on many occasions. He in his Why Socialism article, half the article is based on Marx. But he gave speeches to he gave talks on science to Marxist working class organizations in Germany. There was a continuity there in terms of his respect for Marx and his use of his ideas and development of them. And he also thought well of Lenin. He said that his tactics differed from those of Lenin, but he thought that Lenin's cause was his cause, essentially, and that he was one of the great figures, progressive figures in history. So Einstein, although he was very careful about his choice of words, he was strongly complimentary towards Lenin.
Did Einstein believe revolutionary change was necessary?
Well, there were times, when he, in Germany, right after the First World War, there was revolutionary activity, and Einstein made it very clear that he was on the side of that revolutionary activity. Of course, it was a question of overthrowing monarchies and corrupt regimes. In terms of revolution in general, I think that he thought the Russian Revolution was necessary. I don't think he would have thought that a revolution in the United States was necessary in his time exactly. Not what we often think of revolution in terms of insurrection, but he did think that a radical New Deal, creation of socialism, hopefully through democratic means, was necessary in the United States. Whether you call that revolution or not is a question of semantics.
Albert Einstein fled Hitler's Germany. He immigrated to the U.S. in 1933. When did the FBI open a file on Einstein, and for what reason?
Well, they opened a file on Einstein when he was applying to immigrate into the United States. And so, what was that, in 1932? And they opened a file. The thrust of what the FBI was doing at the time was against admitting Einstein. There was an organization, the Woman Patriot Corporation, a very strange name, but it was a big lobbying group, and they argued that Einstein was more connected to socialist groups around the world than Joseph Stalin was, and that Einstein should be kept out of the United States. And the FBI put that in first place in its FBI file, but he was admitted into the U.S. And the FBI kept on following him. They had their file on him, thousands of pages, that lasted for the rest of his life. They were involved in surveillance of him from that time on.
Einstein wrote a famous letter to FDR on August 2nd, 1939. So this is 6 years after he arrived in the U.S. What did he say in that letter?
That's his famous letter where he advised FDR that it was possible to create an atomic bomb, and essentially advised that the United States take action itself to make sure that Germany was not the only country with an atom bomb. But Einstein was actually not part of the Manhattan Project and was not included in all the discussions at that time. He was excluded by the military and the FBI on the grounds that he was a security risk because he was a socialist.
Tell us about how and why Albert Einstein was included in an issue of Life magazine in April 1949.
Life magazine brought out this very shocking photo display of, I think it was the 50 fellow travelers of communism, and they included Einstein and Leonard Bernstein and a lot of major figures in the United States that were then being presented as though they were communists and so on. It included Lillian Hellman and Langston Hughes and Vito Marcantonio and Arthur Miller, Dorothy Parker. But Einstein, of course, was the most famous of all of them. And Life was condemning them all as essentially communists.
Yeah, I think Charlie Chaplin was also part of that two-page spread in Life magazine. This was part of the Red Scare, which had begun when?
I think it really began right after the war in 1946, 47. But the first signs of it were the struggle over Brandeis University. Einstein was involved in the funding of the new university, Brandeis University, which was a university that was inspired by the Jewish community, although it wasn't going to be exclusively Jewish university, of course. And Einstein was really at the center of the funding effort. Their whole foundation was the Albert Einstein Foundation for Higher Education. And in that context, Einstein was trying to create a more open university, a university where there was more access from the population, not based on simply on income, and where the Jewish population and minority populations generally had access to the university, were going to be allowed into the university without the kinds of quota systems that existed at that time. And they were going to put the university under the control of the faculty and not have a board of trustees that ran everything. And the whole thing fell apart when certain people involved in the effort from the board of trustees started saying that this was communist and raising Red Scare issues and so on. They had begun to attack higher education, but this was one of the very first instances of that, attacking it on a Red Scare basis. So Einstein had actually been involved with a number of socialists in coming up with a plan, including Paul Sweezy, who was to become editor of Monthly Review, and Leo Huberman, and Einstein's great friend Otto Nathan, who was also a socialist. And they had this idea of a new kind of university, and it was stopped on the basis of Red Scare politics, anti-communism.
That's John Bellamy Foster, editor of Monthly Review magazine, professor emeritus of sociology at the University of Oregon. To the May 2024 issue of Monthly Review, he wrote about Einstein's political views and about the essay Einstein contributed to the very first issue of Monthly Review magazine 75 years ago. That was May 1949, and we'll certainly talk about that essay by Albert Einstein called Why Socialism? Right, so as I understand it, there was a conservative trustee of Brandeis, the chair of Brandeis's board of trustees, George Alpert, who suddenly came out in opposition to somebody, Harold Lasky, who Albert Einstein and others had asked, had invited to become the first president of Brandeis. What did Einstein do in response to Alpert saying, no, we can't have Lasky as our first president?
Lasky had already declined the position of president of Brandeis when they started attacking Einstein for having nominated a socialist as president. They claimed that Einstein didn't have the right to do that, which wasn't true. They also claimed that they couldn't have a socialist as a head of a U.S. university, no matter how famous. And of course, Lasky was one of the most prominent Jewish thinkers in Britain. So it fit with what Brandeis was supposed to represent. But the idea of Alpert and others was that this had to be a standard university, and even a conservative university controlled by board of trustees. The 75-page report that Sweezy had written and that Einstein supported was thrown out. And the idea that you could have a socialist at the head of the university was declared un-American. Einstein was declared as un-American in his attitudes, in his politics. But this was a surprise at the time, because prior to that, there had been a popular front politically, and that kind of attack had not occurred previously in U.S. universities, certainly not in the 1930s and early 40s. That sort of thing didn't exist, and then suddenly you have this Red Scare.
Yeah, and just to say that Lasky, when he was invited to be the first president of Brandeis, he was then a professor at London School of Economics, and he wrote the 1939 article, Why I Am a Marxist. 1948, the year that Brandeis University was founded, was also the year of a presidential race. Which candidate in 1948 did Einstein support?
Well, after the defeat over Brandeis University, Einstein poured himself into the Henry Wallace campaign for president. Henry Wallace was a former vice president of the United States and former secretary of commerce. And he stood for the whole left part of the New Deal, actually for the New Deal as it had existed under Roosevelt. Truman was a much more conservative political figure, so the Democratic Party supported Truman, but Wallace ran under the Progressive Party, and Leo Huberman and Paul Sweezy wrote the prologue to the Progressive Party platform, and Einstein was very directly involved in the Progressive Party. There's a famous picture of Einstein together with Henry Wallace and Paul Robeson. The whole civil rights struggle was on the side of the Progressive Party. So this was something that he was deeply engaged in. But Otto Nathan and Paul Sweezy and Leo Huberman, who had been really struggling with him over creating this more open university at Brandeis, they lost at that. They all moved into supporting the Wallace campaign in 1948. And when the Wallace campaign was defeated, they all moved towards starting the magazine Monthly Review.
Yeah, so they all turned their attention toward founding an independent socialist periodical, which they called Monthly Review. So why did they think that at that particular time an independent socialist magazine was necessary?
Well, the Red Scare, the McCarthy era, had already started. I mean, McCarthy wasn't present at this time, but McCarthyism was rampant. In fact, Truman, in order to keep Wallace from getting a large number of votes, he had red-baited him. And in some ways, that was crucial in the development of McCarthyism. So the Democrats really got it going during the election. There was a shift to the right, a dramatic shift to the right in U.S. politics, and an attack on on the left, the socialist left, with the center liberals joining in these McCarthyite attacks. And in this context, they felt that it was necessary to explain what socialism really was to American population and to keep the ideas alive. And the magazine was designed to serve that purpose. The original editors were Leo Uberman Sweezy and Otto Nathan, but Otto Nathan, who didn't have a permanent position because he was Jewish and a socialist, aside from the fact that he was Einstein's closest friend, he was persecuted. He couldn't get a tenure track position. So he kept himself off of the editorial board and then moved away eventually. But he was part of the original design of Monthly Review. And then Einstein, of course, was fully behind initiating the magazine.
John Bellamy Foster, editor of Monthly Review and professor emeritus of sociology at the University of Oregon, joining us on Against the Grain. I'm C.S. Song. Who asked Einstein to contribute an essay to that first issue?
I think it was sort of a joint decision, but it was certainly Otto Nathan who got Einstein to write the article. And the original idea was for Einstein to write Why I Am a Socialist. You mentioned that Lasky wrote an article for The Nation called Why I Am a Marxist. But it was very common in those days to write a piece, Why I Am a Socialist. But Einstein declined to do that. Instead, he decided to write an article called Why Socialism?
Yeah, interesting. And is that because he wanted to make a case for socialism? He didn't want to just speak personally about his own convictions?
Yeah, exactly. And of course, he took on an awful lot. I mean, he had written about socialism previously, but this was his most developed statement on it. And to write an article, Why Socialism, was a much bigger task than just writing about himself, how he came to socialism, which he didn't think was that important. What he thought was important is why we should be socialists, why we should all be socialists. What is it that demands socialism in our society today? And he had two major sources of inspiration. One was Thorsten Veblen, who C. Wright Mills said was the greatest critic of America that America has produced. And he was very influenced by Veblen, particularly Veblen's attempt to bring a kind of social psychology into the explanation of socialism, the defense of socialism. And then the other source of inspiration was, of course, Marx and Marx's whole theory of exploitation and what ensued from that. So these were the two theoretical foundations that Einstein utilized. But he started with the question of the individual via Veblen, why the individual is in such a terrible position in our society, why the individual is alienated. He quoted one person that he had invited to his home who said that he couldn't understand why Einstein was interested in the preservation of the human race. Einstein, of course, was very much involved in trying to rid the world of nuclear weapons after 1945. And this associate of his had said he couldn't understand why Einstein was interested in preserving the human race. And Einstein said this is a sign of an individual, and that's common in our society, who's lost their equilibrium has lost their moral standards, and even their capability to think about society in moral terms. And he traced this to capitalism and argued that socialism was the only way out of this trap.
And as far as the Marxian influence on Einstein in this essay, are we talking there about the way that Einstein talks about ownership of the means of production and the fact that workers are forced to sell their labor power to capitalists who appropriate the fruits of production, that kind of thing?
Yeah, it follows Marx's theory of exploitation, Marx's theory of class inequality, of the class structure of society. It follows Marx's notion of labor as the source of value, economic surplus value, etc. It's all there in a few paragraphs, but Einstein saw that as something that you really couldn't even argue against. It was as clear as day to him, and he presented it in very, very clear terms.
Yeah, that's something notable about this essay, right? That it's very succinct. I think it's something like 6 pages long. It's both dense and accessible, fair to say?
Yes. I mean, it's a masterpiece in that sense. A lot of people have been interested in this essay. It's read frequently just because Einstein wrote it. But I think the importance of it isn't simply that Einstein wrote it, and so therefore Einstein is a socialist, which we know anyway, but rather the nature of the argument itself, its succinctness, its power, its undeniability. It's a masterpiece in itself. It should be approached that way. So I tried to approach it that way in the article. And a lot of the attempts to deal with this in terms of the establishment or the mainstream have been directed at trying to pretend that Einstein was really making liberal arguments and that Einstein was a liberal, which of course goes against the nature of the argument itself and everything we know about Einstein. But there's the attempt to sort of draw him into the liberal mainstream and de-emphasize what he really stood for. You see the same thing done with figures like Martin Luther King or W.E.B. Du Bois, you know, and others. Their real ideas are downplayed and they're somehow made over into liberals, which actually contradicts what they were saying. So it's very important to read Einstein's essay closely for this reason. Not only is it a masterpiece in thought and in terms of explanation of why we need socialism, why socialism, but it's also very clear just how deep Einstein's own socialism was, and it contradicts any attempt to import him into the mainstream. And of course, the establishment in his day knew that he was a radical. That's why we have thousands of pages of FBI file material on him.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. John Bellamy Foster joins me, editor of Monthly Review Magazine, professor emeritus of sociology at the University of Oregon. And he writes a lot for Monthly Review. You can find an essay he wrote titled Einstein's Why Socialism and Monthly Review, A Historical Introduction in the May 2024 issue of Monthly Review, which is in its 75th anniversary year. Einstein, Albert Einstein, he tried to make sure that Brandeis was open to African Americans and other marginalized groups, other groups subject to quotas. Tell us more about like what he said about race and racism. You point in your article to a speech he gave when he accepted an honorary degree from Lincoln University in Pennsylvania. This was a historically black university, founded in 1854, the first institution of its kind. What did he say when he accepted the degree?
Well, he was very forthright about the racism in the United States, and he was constantly being offered honorary degrees at this university or that university, the most prestigious universities in the United States, and he turned them all down. But then when the small, historically black university, Lincoln University in Pennsylvania, the first historically black university, offered an honorary degree, he accepted. And he went and explained the racial problem in the U.S. at the time. And he says that he declared that the social outlook of Americans, their sense of equality and human dignity, is limited to men of white skins. Now, he also joined Paul Robeson as co-chair of the American Crusade to End Lynching, which the FBI tried to characterize as a communist front organization. But the truth is that it was an organization aimed at ending lynching, and that can't be simply characterized as communist. But he went over and over again. He stood up on race issues. And when W.E.B. Du Bois was arrested in the McCarthy era for having supported the World Peace Council, which was characterized as a communist front organization, but actually had millions of members all over the world and was oriented towards world peace. But Du Bois was arrested and put on trial, and Vito Marcantonio, the U.S. congressman and lawyer, a real fiery individual, he was defending Du Bois and kept it a secret that Einstein was going to testify on behalf of Du Bois, who, you know, Du Bois was a friend of Einstein. He had written for Du Bois's paper, The Crisis, the NAACP paper, way back in the 1920s, and Einstein and Du Bois were friends, and it was kept secret that Einstein was going to testify on behalf of Du Bois's character. And so Vito Marcantonio said he didn't have any defense witnesses other than Du Bois himself and a one character witness, Albert Einstein. And the judge was so shocked that Einstein was going to come on the stand that he called a recess. And after the recess, he immediately dismissed all charges on Du Bois before Einstein could come to the stand, because the judge realized that it would suddenly be world news if Einstein was there. But Einstein, you know, never backed off from these conflicts. He was in his socialism also meant for him that he had to struggle against race oppression, and he continually spoke out. When he delivered his talk at Lincoln University, the mainstream press didn't cover it at all, which was very unusual, given that it was Einstein speaking, because he spoke out against systematic racism in the United States, and the press didn't cover it. We only have what he said from the report of one black paper, one paper that was owned by African Americans and represented the African American community, and they presented some of what Einstein said.
What about claims that Albert Einstein was a Zionist? This claim has been made by people, including Samuel Graydon, in a Time magazine article published just last December. Any truth to that claim?
Yeah, there is some truth to the claim. I mean, Einstein considered himself a Zionist, but Zionism is actually quite complex in its historical origins, and he's what we call a cultural Zionist rather than political Zionist. He did believe in Israel as a homeland for the Jewish population, for those who were, had been dislocated by Nazi Germany, refugees from Europe, and he was strongly supportive of Israel in that sense, but he was opposed to Israel being a Jewish state. So he was opposed to political Zionism, and he was opposed to the idea that all populations would not be treated equally. So he argued that the state of Israel should equally represent Jews and Palestinians. And he wrote a letter to the New York Times, along with other Jewish leaders in 1948. And the letter was opposed to the development of a new Israeli political movement on the right, associated with Menachem Begin. And in the letter, Einstein and the others, Seymour Melman, Sidney Hook, Hannah Arendt, argued that Begin's Freedom Party was a political party closely akin in its organization methods, political philosophy, and social appeal to the Nazi and fascist parties. And of course, Begin's Freedom Party, it was really the beginning of the political movement that rules Israel today. It was the start of that. And Einstein said that this was a party that in its forms of organization and its goals was similar to the Nazi and fascist parties. So it's very clear where he stood. The Time magazine article that you mentioned doesn't refer to this letter, I believe. It certainly doesn't quote what Einstein said. It starts out by saying Einstein was a Zionist, and then goes off into other issues because it wants to avoid the actual facts of the matter. He certainly was opposed to the kinds of measures that the Israeli government represents today, and he was opposed to essentially an apartheid state. He made it clear right in the beginning. There's absolutely no doubt where he would stand today. He would stand with that part of the Jewish community that's leading in the United States, that's leading the struggle on behalf of the Palestinians in Gaza.
That's the voice of John Bellamy Foster, editor of Monthly Review magazine, which turned 75 this year. John's books include Marx's Ecology, The Return of Nature, The Robbery of Nature, co-authored with Brett Clark. And to the May 2024 issue of Monthly Review, he contributed an essay titled Einstein's Why Socialism and Monthly Review, A Historical Introduction. John, your new book is The Dialectics of Ecology. What do you mean by the dialectics of ecology?
Well, there's an old term on the left, the dialectics of nature. It's associated with Frederick Engels' work, The Dialectics of Nature. And in that work, the attempt is made to understand nature in materialist and dialectical terms, that is, to understand nature in and of itself and the complex relations that govern nature and our relations to nature. So that's what the Dialectics of Nature is about. And Engels in that work says at one point that nature is the proof of dialectics. Now that sounds maybe a little bit odd to us today, but if you change the sentence a little bit to what Engels really meant in our terms today, it would read, ecology is the proof of dialectics. And that doesn't sound odd to us at all. In fact, we understand, we recognize that ecological thinking requires that we have a dialectical perception that looks at the complex relations between humanity and nature and how nature evolves, how we're caught up in that evolution, how our relations have turned destructive relative to nature, and all of these kinds of questions about nature, the emergence of new forms of reality, the contradictions that have emerged in our relation to the natural world. All of this is involved in the dialectics of ecology. Ecology is the proof of dialectics, but also we need that complex way of thinking that's geared to change and contradiction and emergence and contingency and so on in order to understand the situation we're in. We can no longer afford a dualistic perspective where nature is somewhere else and we're somehow apart from nature. The truth is that the human beings are part of nature. What we do affects the natural world, and we have to focus on those connections. And once you start looking at these problems from a materialist and a dialectical perspective, you begin to understand how we got into the fix that we are in and how we might get out of it. But it, of course, requires social transformation.
So give us an example of how kind of the conceptual work you're doing in your new book relates to concrete developments and maybe even concrete solutions being put forward by thinkers and activists and just regular folks.
Now, the Dialectics of Ecology as a book is not a big book, and it's meant to be readable, but it has this complexity to it, and I wondered whether it would work, or at least whether it would work in the minds of the readers, because it starts off with the theoretical problems of the dialectics of ecology or the dialectics of nature, how we're connected to nature, all of these issues that relate to nature and science and how we're interconnected with that and how it's generated ecological crises. And then from that sort of abstract level, it moves on to more concrete issues. But the idea is that if you understand this sort of dialectical way of thinking, then the more concrete issues take on a different form as well. So then I go on to look at things like the financialization of nature, that is the way in which financial interests, banks and financial interests in general, financial corporations are trying to turn ecosystem services into financial assets and forms of financial ownership, basically owning the earth in a different sort of way, melding it into the financial system. Of course, we know how unstable the financial system is, but they claim they're doing that in order to stabilize our relation to the environment. So I do a critique of that. I look at extractivism and how that's taken extreme forms in our society. But then I go on to look at some of the ways in which we have to think about how we're going to respond to the earth differently in more socialist terms.
Which would mean what? What would such a response to the earth look like? or constitute in terms of human priorities and activities?
One of the issues I deal with is ecological civilization, which is an idea that has developed primarily in China. The idea that we can move on to an ecological civilization, which is no longer primarily determined in by economics, by the economy, but in which environmental interests come to the forefront, and that we stabilize the world in environmental terms, which means not focusing so much on economic expansion, infinite economic expansion, but reaching some kind of level and equilibrium across the world where all countries are using equal amounts of energy and where we've stabilized our relation to the environment and are no longer exceeding what the earth can support. So there's a whole notion of building an ecological civilization. That's one idea. Another issue that's addressed is socialism and ecological survival, because we now have had a 1.5 degree increase in global average temperature for 12 months now. So for a full year, we're at an increase of 1.5 degrees, which used to be considered the barrier, the tipping point, although 2 degrees is a bigger tipping point. And we're already seeing catastrophes across the earth. There's no getting away from it. We're seeing a growth of ecological catastrophes everywhere. I don't want to exaggerate this, but what we're seeing is catastrophes by any definition of catastrophe in human history. This is what is happening. Temperatures are going up enormously. You know, you have places where, like in Mecca, 100 people just died of as a result of a temperature increase. But you have places where temperatures are at 120 degrees or above. And you have sea level rise. You have increased hurricanes, floods, droughts. This is a product of climate change. And so we have to start thinking about human survival, the survival of human communities. And to do that properly, we have to do it on a social basis or a socialist basis, that is, on an egalitarian and community-wide basis. And how do we conceive that? How do we prepare to protect whole communities across the globe? So we can't just talk about stopping climate change anymore, because even though we need to stop it, we have to somehow reach zero, or they say net zero carbon increase. But even if we're on track for that, which, you know, we're supposed to reach by 2050, we're still going to have catastrophes building up in the meantime, because we've already in a way gone too far. So we have to do things to protect communities. So there's a question of socialism and ecological survival. The other issue that's addressed in the book is more controversial. It's a notion of planned degrowth. That's the notion of how do we, you know, where in those countries that are rich countries where our ecological footprints have exceeded what the earth can support, if the whole world was like the United States, we'd need 4 planets. Those countries have to decrease their per capita energy use, and we have to move towards qualitative rather than quantitative development, redistribution, and those sorts of things. So it addresses the issue of planned degrowth in those terms. There is enormous waste in our society. We can eliminate that. There's enormous maldistribution of resources and income. We can address that. We don't actually need to use as much energy as we use. The global equilibrium in terms of per capita energy use is the level of Italy today. And so we would have to live at the level of Italians, you know, in terms of our actual energy use. But that isn't so bad. Italy is not a backward country. So we need to reconceptualize what we do in that respect. Capitalism is like an automobile that doesn't have brakes and doesn't have a steering wheel and doesn't have airbags. And all it's got is an accelerator. All you can do is accelerate it. And we're discouraged even from deceleration, right? But that's not rational. We have to be able to find a way to live within the world as it exists, to find a safe place for humanity. And we can do that by emphasizing qualitative development and community rather than the accumulation of capital. So that's the nature of the argument. There's a lot more to it than that.
The book is The Dialectics of Ecology. It's John Bellamy Foster, my guest's new book. We have a link to that book on our website, as well as to Monthly Review, of which he is editor. He is also Professor Emeritus of Sociology at the University of Oregon. John, thanks very much for your work and for joining us today.
Well, thanks so much for all the good questions.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.